Wednesday, September 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump and Joe Biden face-to-face for the first presidential debate. Coronavirus concerns as cases rise globally and in the United States. Also ahead, with travel way down, one country is offering flights to nowhere. It's all on today's International Edition. As you just heard at the top of the hour, VOA newscast, with just 35 days until the presidential election, President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, ended their first face-to-face debate Tuesday night in Cleveland, Ohio, trading barbs and accusations as the two candidates with starkly different visions for the country discussed how they would face multiple crises. Each side hoped the debate would energize its own debate and sway undecided voters. There were protests outside the debate hall in Cleveland, Ohio. Given the divisive political climate across the country, the city had an enormous police presence. I spoke to VOA correspondent Carolyn Prasuti prior to the event about what she was seeing on the ground outside the debate pavilion.
I'm about two blocks from the debate building. I'm outside the security perimeter right now, standing on a corner. One corner are pro-Trump protesters, and the other corner are pro-Biden protesters. One pro-Trump supporter is waving a flag. He's playing some music. The other side, we also have some signs that say vote anti-abortion on all four corners of this intersection. Now, earlier today, we were at a location that was lined with Cleveland police officers for an entire block, and we knew something was up. There were many military vehicles around this area, and we realized that the president's motorcade was about to arrive. And certainly, as he was arriving, as the first motorcycles were coming down the street, about 3 meters from me, I realized that there were two men wearing dark-colored hoodies and ski masks that were coming up on my left. And just then, I heard a police officer on a bicycle yelling, "Get down, get down." He said, "Take your hands out of your pocket." And of course, he was talking to those two men, and they were immediately arrested. Seconds later, the president then drove into the debate venue in the motorcade. So that was a close one. We have no idea if they meant any harm to the president. It was just how they were dressed that was suspicious, being that they were all in dark clothing with a hoodie, with ski masks and goggles and carrying backpacks.
Was there any indication of what they were doing or trying to do or who they were supporting and not supporting?
No, they carried no signs. They had their hands in their pockets. So they didn't have, we couldn't see what they were holding or if they even had anything in their pockets. And they were immediately loaded onto a white van and taken away from the location. So security has been on high alert all week. Cleveland police officers have been working 12-hour shifts. They're not allowed to have the day off. The governor called up the Ohio National Guard. There are 300 troops in the area. I'm looking right now at about 50 officers. They have helmets and shields on right now, and they're just walking across the street in front of me. So Cleveland security is out in full force. We have police from all over. As I understand it, Cleveland was offering $59 an hour for any out-of-state officers that wanted to come and give assistance with security for this debate. All police officers are on 12-hour shifts. No one allowed to have the day off. The National Guard called up here, Ohio National Guard, 300 troops here, many vehicles, many military vehicles, many police cruisers, a lot of concrete barriers blocking off streets, snow fence all the way around the debate hall with the perimeter pushed out to several blocks from the building, also around the actual pavilion. I would say between maybe 3 meters high, the chain link fencing that is reinforced all around the pavilion. So it's obvious that the debate organizers, the debate commission, wants to keep out any protesters, any troublemakers from the area around the pavilion. There's no way that they will get to the two candidates or even close to that building.
VOA correspondent Carolyn Prasuti. This divisive campaign season comes at a time of crisis and uncertainty as President Trump, his top aides, and the attorney general have repeatedly pushed a narrative that raises concerns about the election's integrity. Intelligence officials have also raised alarms about foreign interference in the election. Joining us is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. He previously served as an associate counsel and advisor to President George W. Bush. Thank you so much for being with us. So this has really sowed a lot of doubt among many Americans. Is there a history of voter fraud in this country? And what do you say to the concerns being raised by the Trump administration?
So there have long been, Lori, concerns about voter integrity in elections going back, you know, decades. This is a hotly debated topic between Republicans and Democrats on whether there is or is not voter fraud, what the nature of that fraud is, whether people who are authorized to vote are voting or are not voting. And mail-in ballots have often been a topic of some debate. Historically, mail-in ballots are thought to cut in favor of Republicans because they tend to be absentee ballots from overseas, oftentimes military voters who tend to generally break Republican. But in this election, there's a concern about the early voting and the like. And so what you're seeing here is a debate about things that have been going on for a long time. On top of that, layer on top of that are what we know to be interference by foreign actors in our electoral politics. Whether they're actually interference with ballots or not, we have no clear evidence of that, but we know that the Russians certainly are seeking to get involved in the way that they were in 2016, that is to say, manipulating people's views on both sides of issues. We believe the Chinese and potentially the Iranians may be doing something similar also, having seen the Russians do it so successfully in 2016. And so there's a lot of debates going on about what the nature of the threat to our electoral system looks like and who's responsible and what they're trying to gain out of that.
How do you respond to the Trump administration continuing to sort of sow doubt about the outcome of the election?
Well, look, I think there's a legitimate debate to be had about whether there's voter fraud or whether there's not voter fraud. But it is significantly problematic when the president of the United States is regularly expressing significant doubt about the validity of our elections, you know, at a time when we know the goal of foreign adversaries is to sow similar doubt. It plays into the hands, unintentionally, apparently, of the hands of foreign actors who would sow doubt about our elections. And that's a huge problem. It doesn't benefit our electoral system, unfortunately.
Do we have any evidence of widespread voter fraud at any point in our history?
You know, Lori, this is a hotly debated topic about whether there is widespread voter fraud or not. I've seen studies on both sides of the issue suggesting that there is or is not significant voter fraud. I don't actually know whether, in fact, there is substantial voter fraud. I can say, having been on the ground during a number of elections, that I have seen things that are concerning as votes are being counted. I've seen ballots in stacks, unsigned envelopes, where an election board is about to count them. So I've seen things that are concerning. I don't know whether those were intentional or unintentional, and I've seen them be resolved by people who are on the ground saying, hey, you know, you need to make sure those things are signed and properly sealed. That being said, I think this has been a hotly contested topic for a long time, and there's not a lot new here in the sense of these debates over voter fraud. What is new here is two things. One, the significant role that we know foreign actors are starting to take and try to play in our elections. And second, the huge quantity of people that will vote either early or through absentee ballots because of the pandemic. These are both unprecedented situations, and I understand why people are concerned about our election system, but it does play into the hands of foreign adversaries who want to undermine our confidence in our elections and in our rule of law institutions when we continue to harp on the potential invalidity of our own elections. It plays right in the hands of foreign actors.
If you could offer some solace or advice to Americans as they head to the polls to vote for their choice for the next president, what would you say to them about their worries about their vote and whether it will be counted?
Look, America is known around the world for being the bastion of electoral democracy and sort of the epitome of what a republic ought to be. We have run elections in this country for 200 years. While there have been debates about those elections and disputes about the outcomes and the like, we've always had free and fair votes. I think we can assume the same is going to happen in this election. The best thing we can do as a country is to go to the polls, cast our ballots, let the outcome be what it is, and engage as we have for 200 years in an appropriate, peaceful transfer of power. Regardless of who is the ultimate candidate elected, whether it's a re-election for the president or the election of the former vice president.
Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. The world has now surpassed 1 million coronavirus deaths since the outbreak began, with the most cases in the United States. Americans are both fearful and impatient about the pandemic, which has killed more than 200,000 people and cost millions of jobs. At least 23 states in the U.S. are seeing a rise in new cases. Meanwhile, the coronavirus is increasingly infecting American children and teens in a trend authorities say appears fueled by school reopenings and the resumption of sports, play dates, and other activities. Children of all ages now make up 10% of all U.S. cases, up from 2% in April, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Meanwhile, Botswana's parliament voted this week to extend by a further 6 months a state of emergency imposed to fight the coronavirus. The move comes despite objections from opposition parties. The extension means President Mokgweetsi Masisi will continue to rule by decree until March 2021. A full year since the pandemic hit Africa. Mukdisi Dube reports from Gaborone.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi, in his address to a special session of parliament, said it was necessary to extend the state of emergency, which came into effect in March.
The disease burden has made it clear and imperative for us to extend the state of public emergency in the interest of the public. In this context, I will request parliament, through a motion, to extend the state of public emergency by a period of 6 months.
Botswana has seen a steady rise in cases since registering its first in March. The country currently has more than 3,170 cases, with 16 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the pandemic. President Masisi added the state of emergency would be used solely for the purpose of fighting the infection.
It is my considered view, though, that the extension of the state of public emergency provides a better option to safeguard the lives of Botswana while containing and controlling the disease.
Among others, President Masisi said the state of emergency would ensure workers are protected against retrenchment and maintain the restrictions on the movement of people in and out of the country. He said the country's Public Health Act was inadequate to fully equip his government to fight the pandemic. Opposition parties said they were not convinced an extension of the state of emergency was necessary. David Tere of the opposition coalition Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, argued against the move.
This is not acceptable. We are restricting movement of people in and outside the country. South Africa has opened up the borders. Namibia has opened up the borders. And we have a treaty with these countries. So you are saying we should continue to close, while others, your neighbors, Your Excellency, have opened.
The leader of the opposition in parliament, Dumelang Salisando, warned the economy will suffer as a result of the extended restrictions.
We are closing down the economy. They need certainty. Households are not going to survive this.
Despite the opposition members' objections, the ruling party's majority in the National Assembly meant the extension was approved. The country's economy is expected to contract by around 9% this year. Its backbone, the diamond industry, suffered significantly after international buyers were shut out due to travel restrictions. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
A group of eminent experts on Yemen accuses Yemen's warring parties of widespread violations, some amounting to war crimes and crimes against humanity. They're calling for an end to impunity and for perpetrators of these crimes to be brought to justice. The report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
For the second consecutive year, the Yemeni government and its Saudi-led coalition partners have refused to grant the group of experts entry into their countries. Nevertheless, the experts managed to gather a ream of evidence from more than 400 witnesses, victims, and other sources through remote and secure channels. What is eminently clear from their 152-page report is that no one in Yemen is safe, that no one has clean hands in this blood-soaked country, that direct warfare, along with hunger and disease, have claimed more than 100,000 civilian lives over the past 6 years. Chair of the group of eminent experts, Kamel Jandoubi, says all warring parties are guilty of committing alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. He speaks through an interpreter.
Airstrikes are being carried out by coalition forces without proper regard to the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution. Both the Houthis and the coalition forces are continuing to deploy indirect fire weapons, such as mortars and rockets, including in heavily populated areas. These indiscriminate attacks are killing and wounding civilians and damaging critical infrastructure, such as health facilities.
The report documents widespread systematic violations, including arbitrary detention, forced disappearance, torture, gender-based and sexual violence. It notes dissidents, human rights defenders, and journalists are at particular risk. It finds boys and girls as young as 7 are recruited into armed forces. Jandoubi says the group of experts has identified potential perpetrators of crimes that have been committed and has given a confidential list of names to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to be used in future prosecutions. He speaks through an interpreter.
The group is concerned that impunity continues largely unabated for those who perpetrate serious violations. To date, no one has been held accountable for the violation that we have identified. We call upon the international community to take a more active role in Yemen and call upon the Security Council to refer the situation in Yemen to the ICC.
Yemen's Deputy Permanent Representative to the UN in Geneva, Mohammed Al-Fokoumi, dismisses the expert group's call for international involvement in his country's affairs. He says the independent Yemeni National Commission of Inquiry is doing a professional job in investigating abuse and is moving to set up special courts for human rights violations. He says the expert's report is based on misleading information, lacks objectivity, impartiality and credibility, and tells the Council there is no need to extend the group's mandate. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afghanistan's senior leadership has told its negotiating team in Doha to be flexible in talks with the Taliban. The man heading Afghanistan's peacemaking efforts is in Pakistan on a 3-day trip. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim is following his visit closely and brings us the details from Islamabad.
We have asked our own delegation, President Ghani and myself, to be patient, to be ready to make compromise, and to not to miss any other opportunity, not to lose opportunity, not to waste time.
This is Abdullah Abdullah, the man responsible for heading the negotiations with the Taliban. His official title is Chairman of the High Council for National Reconciliation. Since Monday, he has been on a 3-day visit to Pakistan to discuss the Afghan peace process. On Tuesday, he addressed the Institute for Strategic Studies, Islamabad, a foreign policy research group which is part of Pakistan's foreign ministry. The visit reflects a shift in bilateral relations between the two countries, which have been at odds for the last couple of years. Both Afghanistan and the United States believe that the Taliban leadership lives in Pakistan. Both Kabul and Washington have demanded that Islamabad pressure the group to come to the negotiating table. As talks with the Taliban progressed, first with the United States, culminating in a deal signed on February 29th of this year, and then between Taliban and Afghan government, relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan also improved. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said his country had gone through a paradigm shift and now wanted to be friends, not masters, of Afghanistan.
And my message is, we have no favorites. My message is, we do not want to meddle in your internal affairs. My message is, we respect and want to respect your sovereignty, your independence, and your territorial integrity.
Both Qureshi and Abdullah highlighted the potential in terms of regional trade and development that could be mutually beneficial if Afghanistan had peace and friendly relations with Pakistan. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Climate change and its resulting loss of biodiversity threatens the planet's habitability for all forms of life, including plant, animal, and microbial. According to the United Nations, 75% of the Earth's land surface has been altered by human actions, and 85% of the world's wetlands have been lost. Life in the oceans is also now threatened as never before. To address the crisis, representatives of most of the UN's member states are meeting for the UN Summit on Biodiversity. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Columbia University professor and research ecologist Shahid Naeem.
One of the challenges of looking at life on Earth is that there's a big scale from the single plant or the single bee all the way up to what's happening at a continental level to what's happening in the biosphere. And you sort of have to scale across all those levels. So at different scales, biodiversity is declining, but declining in different ways. And each of these different ways has different consequences.
What about the biodiversity loss that most of us think of? Animals and plant species, for example.
That has consequences for things like breeding plants and animals for agriculture, or looking for genes that might have useful materials or medicines that we haven't found yet. But if you're looking at it at landscape level, then we have to worry about things like increases in the spread of disease, the loss of pollinator services, and the fact that the habitats don't deal very well with increasing climate variability. So fires, floods run a lot more rampant than they used to. And then if you go all the way down to someone's backyard or their farm, you'll find that the diversity of the plants, the animals, and the microorganisms is declining in just about every way you can imagine. Even if you go into the soil to look at microbial diversity, you'll find that they also are declining. So no matter what scale you're looking at, diversity is declining.
For many of us, especially in the developing world, biodiversity is simply a quality of life issue.
Yes. There are lots of studies that show that green spaces and urban environments provide for better health and better mental health as well. Children especially do much better when they're exposed to more diverse habitats than, say, more sterile habitats in urban environments. But the people who are going to suffer the most are, in fact, the people who often live among biodiversity and really depend on biodiversity. You know, at least 2 billion people in the world are poor. And we have thousands of studies that have shown that if you improve biodiversity, you improve the productivity of the system. And the second thing is you improve the resilience of the system, whether it's plants or animals, whether those animals are livestock or wild animals or fish in the rivers or fish in the ocean. All of that is really valuable.
Some people look at all the biodiversity loss and paint an almost apocalyptic picture for life, including human life. What's your take?
So I think opinions vary. Many of the policy platforms, like Sustainable Development Goals, or some of these things that are coming out from the United Nations, is that we're at crossroads. But crossroads means that we haven't actually crossed into the more dire path yet. But there are people who are much more pessimistic and say that we need to do something now, something drastic, or else. There is some scientific foundation for what they say. But then the others who say we're at crossroads and there's a number of things we can do, and I think the summit that's coming up is going to try to focus on this.
What do you think is needed?
More financing and more capacity building. Because if you say you're going to do something, but you don't have the money to do it, and the people who are going to do it don't have the capacity to do it, then you're not going to be able to achieve your goals. So it really depends on what people want. People actually have to say that they want their tax dollars to go to saving biodiversity. They want to buy food that comes from more diverse habitats, like eco-friendly coffee or sustainable forestry products or sustainable oil palm. But I think the other thing is to make sure that your schools actually include environment in the curriculum. The difficulty with biodiversity is that, unlike climate change, which mostly focuses on dealing with carbon and looking for carbon neutral solutions, biodiversity solutions are much more complex. And so be aware that in addition to climate change, in addition to emerging diseases, in addition to food security, there's also mass extinction. Because if you start to lose biodiversity, you start to lose the foundation of the way the planet works. And then solving those other problems becomes much more difficult.
Columbia University professor and research ecologist Shahid Naeem speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. With international travel almost non-existent because of the coronavirus pandemic, the global tourism industry is finding new and creative ways to make money. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, one way companies in Asia are trying to stay profitable is through so-called flights to nowhere.
It's no secret most of the world's airports have sat empty for months. But some airlines in Asia are trying to change that by offering flights that end up right where they began. It's the flight to nowhere. While it may sound like a gimmick, customers are actually buying tickets. This month, a Taiwanese airline took passengers to South Korea's Jeju Island, circled a few times, and flew right back to Taiwan. In the air, they had a Korean language and culture lesson. This passenger, 35-year-old Lu Chun-hee, says she couldn't go abroad, so her friend recommended this flight. As soon as she heard about it, she wanted to experience the flight to nowhere. The flights are not cheap. Australia's Qantas airline charged almost $800 for an economy seat on a flight that offered views of attractions such as the Great Barrier Reef. The flight sold out in 10 minutes. In Japan, the flights don't even leave the ground. An entertainment company offers flights in a fake airport cabin. Passengers get meals and tour famous sites through virtual reality headsets. Hirari Ito is a virtual flight attendant. She's never been a flight attendant in real life, and she says it was hard to learn how to become one now.
We've been, like, changing and trying to improve every day, so I hope it will last for a long time in the long run.
The trend is a sign people are eager to be done with quarantine and other restrictions, says digital marketing analyst Ming-Ming Chen.
The problem is, if you want to travel to other countries, you have to go through all the safety procedures. You have to have your COVID-19 tested, and you need to go through quarantines. And it's really not convenient for a lot of people.
But while the flights to nowhere may provide a boost for travel companies, they don't help the broader tourist industry. Here in Seoul, many shopping districts that rely on foreigners are mostly empty, waiting for the flood of tourist dollars that may not come anytime soon. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Performances for the 2020 Billboard Music Awards have just been announced. Alicia Keys, Bad Bunny, Luke Combs, and leading nominee Post Malone will all perform for the October 14th show that will be broadcast live at the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles, California. With restrictions set due to the COVID-19 pandemic, it's not yet clear if the performances will be live or pre-taped. The awards show was originally supposed to take place in April, but was postponed because of the coronavirus. Kelly Clarkson will be hosting the Billboard Awards. Malone has 16 nominations. Other top competitors, including Billie Eilish, Taylor Swift, and the Jonas Brothers. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for today's show, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening.